Right now, we got Mark Dorson here in the studio from the Orange County Board of Commissioners and also the Chambers Center now, formerly the UNC Center for Civil Rights, but moving on outside the university. How are you?
I am well. I am very well. Thank you. Yeah, still, well, you know, I'm still the managing attorney at the UNC Center for Civil Rights, at least for another couple of months,
yep.
Till January 12th. And but we, you know, in an effort to figure out how best to transition the advocacy work and continue the client community representation away from UNC. And we're looking at a bunch of different options, one of which is possibly just becoming a separate 501c3 entity. Other options include becoming part of an existing social justice organization, either, you know, a statewide one or a national organization that might come to North Carolina. But in any case, the interim necessary step was to set up, you know, to file the articles of incorporation for the Julius L. Chambers Center for Civil Rights, which I'm proud and honored to see that has now been established. And so we're continuing to sort of figure out the transition plan away from UNC.
No, one way or the other, that advocacy work will continue?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, Elizabeth Haddix, my colleague, and I are committed to continuing Julius Chambers' vision for direct advocacy and engagement, you know, in the struggle against race discrimination. And, you know, we're going to continue to represent the communities and clients that we already have, as well as hopefully expand that work.
How long is it going to take to know exactly what the sort of long-term future structure will be?
I think we're hoping to figure that out in the next 2 weeks. I think there's a lot of, you know, one of the things we'll obviously have to do is raise money. And one of the things we've heard from fundraisers is, we love the work, we're committed to it, we just want to know what the plan is. So we're really trying to get all that pinned down in the next 2 weeks.
And obviously with the UNC Center, there was a lot of work with UNC law students. That was part of the point. So will that connection continue at all? I mean, it's got to be outside of the official umbrella of the law school, but will you still be working with students?
That is certainly a core goal of the work continuing. I mean, part of Julius's vision, and certainly part of the center's model, was training the next generation of public interest and civil rights lawyers. And so wherever we end up, we want to continue to have a pipeline of students who are interested in this work from UNC. But also, no longer being at UNC means we'll be able to provide those opportunities to students at other law schools like Duke, Central, Campbell. You know, there are several law schools in the region, and we'd certainly see that as a core function of the work going forward.
So when all is said and done, and obviously we don't know exactly what the final shape of the Chambers Center is going to be, for having to leave the umbrella of UNC, what's going to be lost? What's going to be more difficult as a result of that, if anything?
Well, I think the student connection is certainly going to be more difficult. I mean, the convenience of being part of the law school, you know, regularly having the work woven into the student experience, you know, it'll be harder to maintain that. It'll be harder to, you know, and depending on where we end up, you got to get the students from the campus to wherever you are. I mean, just the physics of it. So that will be difficult. The other piece that we really need to work on maintaining is the connections we have with other departments and resources at the university. So a lot of our work, we really rely on and collaborate closely with folks in the School of Education on school cases, folks in the School of Public Health on environmental justice type cases, the School of Government, city and regional planning, and the law school, of course. And so those resources, you know, we'll have to make sure that we work diligently to maintain, and having those connections are important. And with the broader, you know, with the whole undergrad student body as well.
Yeah. Speaking with Mark Dorson, and we're talking about the Chambers Center, which now exists, and the future shape of it is taking shape pretty much even as we speak. And it's extremely important, as we know, because there's so many important civil rights issues that are unfolding and taking shape and need to be advocated for and litigated in North Carolina and across the country. And one of the big ones that we're talking about this week is gerrymandering, racial and partisan, both of which are civil rights issues.
That's right. And, you know, I was just at a conference earlier this week up in Boston around school integration, the future of school integration. And, you know, there were folks from all around the country at this conference, and all of them, you know, said in various ways that North Carolina is ground zero for the civil rights struggle now on all fronts, but particularly on the issues of voting rights. And so, you know, it's always, you know, we're here, all of us living it and every day, but it's always an interesting reminder when folks from other places tell you, you know, all eyes are on North Carolina.
What do you know about the concept of a special master being appointed? We've been talking about this since the ruling, the not the ruling, but the order came down yesterday from the three-judge panel in Greensboro. They're appointing a special master, this law professor from Stanford who specializes in gerrymandering redistricting issues. He's going to help them look at these nine districts and determine if it's a if it constitutes a racial gerrymander. What should we draw from that in terms of understanding what's going on in the judges' minds? How common is it for the judges to do this? Do we expect them to end up down the road issuing a ruling saying we're going to draw the lines ourselves and take it out of the hands of the General Assembly? What are we thinking here?
So, it, you know, the idea of bringing in a special master in a complex case like this is not unusual. Mm-hmm. You see them in voting rights cases. You see them in sometimes in historically in school desegregation cases. It arises in a situation like we have here where the parties were given an opportunity, or the party that had the responsibility to create the policy or plan or proposal either refused to do so or did so in such a way that the court continued to find unacceptable. So again, in the school context, you know, in the history of school segregation, you know, the court would find that there was discrimination, and they would say to the school board, okay, come up with a plan to fix this. Mm. And the school board would come up with a plan. And if the plan was insufficient or inadequate, they might give them another chance and another chance, which is what happened here. And then the court says, you know, we don't believe that you can or will do this. And so we're going to get, and recognizing that the judges themselves are not experts, mm-hmm. so they just like the plaintiffs and the defendants hire expert witnesses to present their evidence, this is the special master is in many ways like an expert retained by the court. And I think what will happen is, I don't know all the specifics of the charge that they've given him or even if they've done that yet, but I think what will happen is the special master will actually create a plan. We'll have the maps and say, here it is. And then the judges will evaluate it, determine it if it meets the criteria they've interpreted, and then they will impose that plan.
That's really interesting. I was speaking with Mark Dorison again. Just hearing you talk about gerrymandering, you keep bringing up school districts and segregation and integration. You mentioned the conference in Boston. And it occurs to me that that's a gerrymandering issue too, right? And like, it's not just legislative district lines, but we also see that throughout American history post-integration, I guess, and on into today and in North Carolina and across the state, where school districts will draw the lines to intentionally include certain people and leave others out.
That's exactly right. You know, a lot of the work that we've done at the center and a lot of work that's done around civil rights generally nowadays looks at the idea of what they call spatial inequality, sort of the legacy of residential segregation, the policies and patterns and practices of our governments, state, local, and federal, that really separated us where we live by race. And, you know, none of that happened by accident. And and what we know is that once you separate where people live and you create this spatial, you know, separation, then that creates the foundation by which you then draw lines, any lines, lines for where people vote, for voting districts, yeah, lines for where people go to school, lines where the town boundaries are, who's inside the town and gets services and who's outside the town. You know, the whole range of benefits and services and privileges and protections that are part of being included in the community can be parsed out based on where you live. And you know, there have been numerous studies that, you know, that based on your zip code, that the, you know, statisticians can determine the likelihood that you'll graduate high school, mm-hmm. the likelihood that you'll graduate college, that you'll be incarcerated. And so you're exactly right. It is, you know, it is a broad form of gerrymandering in all these counts.
Yeah, and it's bad enough when we see those disparities from country to country, right? And we look at like life expectancy rates and health rates in the United States versus Sweden versus Mozambique versus Indonesia and everywhere else, that there's such a big disparity from one country to another. But you're right, that same disparity exists within the United States, within North Carolina, even sometimes within our own county, that the zip code makes a big difference.
That's exactly right. You know, yeah, we see it within the county, between counties, among counties. There are real substantial differences. You know, I was just reading an article about the legislature is about to start studying school funding. And it was pointing out, you know, if you're a kid in Orange County, you know, there's $4,700 additional dollars per pupil. If you're a kid in Swain County, it's only $400.
Yeah.
And so, you know, those are critical differences that really help determine the likelihood of, you know, success, civic engagement, you know, the whole range of experiences.
Speaking with Mark Dorison again, and let's bring it into Orange County, because we're talking about gerrymandering, which involves the 2018 election, really. But there's an election going on right now, early voting underway, where I'm counting every day. We're a couple hundred votes behind the record pace for an odd year local election, which is 2011. But I have every faith that we'll catch up between now and next Saturday. But we're still way off. I mean, the record is just this fascinating number that I keep repeating on the air. So I'm sure everyone's bored with it by now. But 4,243 people voted early in Orange County in 2011, which is the record for an odd year local election. Last year, on day one of the early voting period in the presidential election, we had like 5,300 people voting. And local elections are as important, if not more, in terms of daily life than the state elections and the national elections. So we've got to do a better job, and I'm speaking for myself here, of getting the word out to people that these are the important issues that people need to vote on.
Well, I think you've done, and CHL has done a great job in with these local elections, and, you know, making information available about all the candidates. It's real tough, you know, and there's an ongoing debate about whether these local elections should be put on even years to improve turnout. You know, the downside is people say the ballot will be so long, no one will read all the way down, or the candidates' messages will be lost in the sea of other campaigns. But it really is hard to really help people understand that the decisions that are made by the town council and the school board and the county commissioners are the ones that most directly impact your lives.
Yep.
And so it is challenging to, you know, the record was 4,000 something. I mean, what percentage was that actually?
Turnout's typically like 15%, right? And that's in Orange County, where everyone is super engaged in politics and talks about it all the time. 15% turnout for a local election. And what's 4,000 out of 100,000, I guess, 75,000, I guess, eligible voters? So you're talking less than 10%.
Yeah. So it's discouraging, you know, and of course, it's always hard to engage students, you know, the UNC students in the local elections, even though there's a lot of good organizing going on campus. Yeah. So it is difficult, but I, you know, it's not completely surprising. I mean, I have people, you know, every week I'll have someone say to me, you know, what do county commissioners even do?
Yeah, yeah.
So,
well, I mean, Silent Sam is one of the big issues for the Chapel Hill Town Council, and that's such a UNC decision.
That's right.
So even for the people who are holding the forums and everything, yeah. So for people, so as we're getting the word out about the fact that local elections are upcoming, early voting is going on, it's so important to vote, what are the big issues that people ought to care about in Orange County, but specifically Chapel Hill Carborough, because we're here?
Well, one of the big things that we continue to struggle with is affordable housing and issues of how we are going to continue to make that available, maximize the resources we have for that. I know a lot of that's an issue that comes up in each of these forums. You know, we're at the point in Orange County where, of course, everybody's for more affordable housing, but we're still struggling on getting some clear, defined plans in place on how to do that. And so one of the things that we're certainly working on the county level is trying to coordinate better with the towns. I just gave a talk last night at the IFC annual meeting, and one of the points one of the bullet points I had in the talk was that Orange County has the grossest income disparity of any county in North Carolina. So the gap between, you know, the lowest wealth folks in the community and the highest wealth folks is wider than any other community. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that tells us that we've got to be doing something more bold, more strategic around these issues of economic injustice or economic inequality. So that's housing, that's job opportunities and, you know, basic economic development, living wage. And those are all good, you know, buzzwords. Yeah. But yeah, what we need is really some creative energy on how to do that. You know, there's lots of development going on. There's lots of potential. But, you know, it's really critical that we think deliberately and creatively about how to capitalize on the opportunity and what I think is generally the goodwill of the people in this community to address those social inequities.
You want to make any endorsements?
Well, I want to endorse, you know, I'm supporting my friend Lydia Lavelle for the mayor of Carrboro. I'm supporting, you know, Barbara Fushi and Sammy Slade are my, you know, my two number one picks in Carrboro. Although we've got, you know, all the candidates running are doing good work. Mm. I'm very excited to see my friend and colleague at the Center for Civil Rights, Alan Buensi, in Chapel Hill, and Karen Stegman and Maria Palmer, I think are all great candidates, and I hope folks come out and endorse them and support them. I think, you know, in Chapel Hill, it's really going to be interesting because I think there's going to be, you know, there's going to be at least two and maybe more new people on the board. So it's a really, and it's interesting because it's a relatively young in the terms of experience board. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of, you know, a lot of folks on there are in their first term or just in their second term. So they're in Chapel Hill especially, it seems like there's a real opportunity to embrace change.
Yeah. This is always the odd time of year for me because I mean, we were talking before our conversation started that WCHL doesn't ever endorse. This is not something that we do. So this entire period is the time when I'm listening to all of the candidates and hearing them speak and getting their opinions on issues and what the priorities are and what they want to do. And I'm standing here with this live microphone like, oh, I really want to just tell people who to vote for. And I'm like, nope, holding back. Maybe at 7:30 on election night.
Well,
I'll start saying what I really think.
One of the, you know, I'll give you this bit of feedback that I've heard from you. It seems like it's been a pretty brutal campaign season for mm-hmm. these candidates. I mean, I know there were a lot of forums when I was running for the county commissioner, but it doesn't seem like anywhere near the number they
like
have
dozens,
right now.
And, yeah.
And so we ought to figure out a way to put some of those together and have bigger forums and, you know, yeah. multiple groups working together.
Well, the NAACP and the League of Women Voters and the PTA Council came together and had one big forum for everyone, so maybe more collaboration there. But as soon as you collaborate, then this organization has this list of 10 questions,
right.
and this organization has 10 more, and you end up with a four-hour forum anyway.
Well, I've told many of the people I know who are running for the first time that if they get elected, it takes less time.
Yeah.
Running is much harder than actually being on the board, so.
What's going on in county news right now?
Well, we've got, you know, we've got a meeting coming up next week, and one of the interesting things on the agenda, which is very exciting, is we're going to be discussing awarding the first contracts for the, you know, expansion and redevelopment of the Southern Human Services Center and the Seymour Center. So that's a multi-year project, but it's really an exciting one, and it's going to bring expansions to the Seymour Center, expansions to the Southern Human Services Center, making access much easier, and you know, and around the Veterans Memorial. So that's the one, you know, thing that's moving forward that we're excited about. And then we've got in a couple of weeks we have the annual Assembly of Governments meeting, which is, you know, we all get together and you know, those used to be a lot of just presentations from staff, and you know, over the past several years the leaders in the different governments have really worked to make it more of an interactive work mm-hmm. session between elected officials. And so I'm looking forward to that. There's a lot to discuss around the Green Tract, a lot to discuss around joint planning in some of these, you know, areas on the edges of the town, Old 86, 54, Millhouse Road. So it seems that we're on the, you know, we're on the precipice of a lot of really exciting potential new development and opportunities for collaboration.
Awesome. OrangeCountyNC.gov for more info on the county. Mark Dorison, thank you so much.
You're welcome. It's great to see you as always.